then began changing, veering. A lord of the Galane and a soul taken. Well, the lord of Moonspawn growled, so am I. The Tista Andi spread his arms wide, then rose upward. Corralled Galane's sorcery swirled around him, blending his clothing, his massive sword drawing all inward to the shape he now climbed toward. The veering was smooth, eloquent, as jet-black wings unfolded from his shoulders. Flesh and bone surged in size, changed in shape. As he flew higher, eyes fixed on the stars, Anamanda Rake became a black dragon, silver-maned, and dwarfing even Silana. His eyes gleamed silver, the vertical slits of the pupils dilating. His breath gusted in heavy grunts, the snap of his wings loud amid the deep groan of muscle on bone. His chest swelled to draw in the cold, dry air, and power filled his being. Rake climbed ever higher, slipping through a stray cloud that scudded in darkness over the city. When he finally tilted his wings forward and caressed the surface of a wayward wind, he looked down on a city that glimmered like a mottled copper coin at the bottom of a pellucid pond. Sorcery flared occasionally, centered mostly in the estate district, and Rake sensed death within these emanations. He considered the message delivered by Serrat, courtesy of a foul mage he'd thought 1,000 leagues away. Was the sorcery the work of these unwelcome intruders? He rumbled in frustration. He would deal with them later. Before him now was a battle. The Empress and her Empire had challenged him again and again, willful in the desire to test his strength. Each time he'd withdrawn, unwilling to commit himself. Very well, Empress. My patience is at an end. The membrane of his wings tautened, the joints creaking, as he grunted a straining breath. He hung almost motionless for a second, studying the great city beneath him. Then, tucking in his wings, Anamanda Rake, the son of darkness and lord of Moonspawn, plummeted. Kalam knew the pattern of detonation the saboteurs would follow. He skirted one side of the street as he ran. So what if Moonspawn hung over them, as if ready to descend on the city, and crush the life from it like a god's heel? Fiddler and Hedge wouldn't give a damn. They had a job to do. The assassin cursed every stubborn bone in their heads. Why didn't they run away like normal, sane people? He came to a corner and crossed the intersection diagonally. Ahead, at the far end of the street, rose Majesty Hill. As he reached the corner, he almost collided with the two saboteurs. Fiddler darted to one side of him, Hedge to the other, running as if not even recognizing him, terror plain on their faces. Kalam reached back and with each hand grasped at Cloak's hood. Then he grunted in pain as the two men jerked him backward and off his feet.
Damn you bastards, he yelled. Hold it!
It's Cal, Hedge yelled.
Kalam twisted around to find a rusty shortsword inches from his face, with Fiddler's white face and wide eyes immediately behind it.
Put that piece of junk away, the assassin snapped. You want to give me an infection?
We're getting out of here, Hedge hissed. Forget the damn mines, forget everything.
Still gripping their cloaks, Kalam shook them both.
Calm down. What's happened?
Fiddler moaned and pointed up the street. Turning, Kalam stiffened. A 12-foot-tall creature shambled down the middle of the road, hunched shoulders wrapped in a glittering cape with a high cowl. A two-bladed axe was slung in its wide dragonhide belt, its handle as long as Kalam was tall. The creature's wide, squat face held two slitted eyes.
Ah, hood's gating back, the assassin muttered. That's Taishrin's precious lord.
He pushed the two saboteurs around the corner.
Kept moving. Back to Simtal's estate.
Neither objected, and moments later were running as fast as they could down the street. Kalam crouched at the corner and waited for the Galane lord to come into view. When it did, he blanched.
soul taken.
De Galen was assuming a form better suited to wholesale destruction. The dun-brown dragon paused, its wingtips brushing the buildings on either side. Its rumble trembled the cobbles. Kalam watched as the creature tensed its limbs, then rose upward on a wave of power. The darkness swallowed it.
"Hood's breath," he said. "Now things are going to get messy."
He whirled and ran to catch up with the saboteurs. The coin-bearer came to a street lined with walled estates. He slowed his pace, studying each structure he passed. The time had come, the adjunct knew. Before the boy had a chance to get inside one of those places, where he might find protection. She adjusted her grip on the sword, padding in silence, not 15 feet behind him. She drew a long, deep breath, then surged forward, sword's point extended. At the sharp ringing clang of metal immediately behind him, Crocus dived forward. He dipped a shoulder and rolled, regaining his feet. He cried out in shock. The woman who had attacked Cole in the hills was in a whirlwind exchange with a tall, round-shouldered man with two scimitars. The thief's jaw dropped as he watched the fight. As good as the woman had shown herself against Cole, she was now being driven back as a flurry of attacks swept around her. They both moved so quickly that Crocus could not even see the parries or the blades themselves, but as he watched, he saw the blossoming of wounds on the woman, her arms, legs. Chest. Her expression held complete disbelief. Then a voice chuckled beside him.
"He's good, ain't he?"
Crocus whirled to see a tall, thin man wearing a grey and crimson long coat, his hands in its pockets. He swung a narrow hatchet face to the thief and grinned.
"You heading somewhere, boy? Somewhere safe?"
Crocus nodded numbly. The man's grin widened.
"I'll escort you, then. And don't worry, you're covered from the roofs, too. Carl's up there. Damn his snakeskin hide. But he's a powerful mage, anyway. Surratt was furious, I hear. Let's walk, then."
Crocus let the man take his arm and lead him away from the duel. The thief cast a glance over his shoulder. The woman was trying to disengage now, her left arm hanging useless and glistening in the gaslight. Her opponent continued pressing, silent as a ghost.
"Don't worry," the man beside him said, pulling him along. "That's Corporal Blues. He lives for this stuff."
Corporal?
"We've been covering your back, coin-bearer."
The man's other hand reached up to his collar, which he turned back to reveal a brooch.
"The name's Finkers. Sixth Blade, Crimson Guard. You're being protected, boy. Compliments of Prince Kaz and Caladan Brood."
Crocus stared. Then he scowled.
"Coin-bearer? What's that mean? I think you've got the wrong person."
Fingers laughed dryly.
"We figured you was walking blind and dumb, boy. The only explanation. You've got other people trying to protect you too, you know. There's a coin in your pocket. Probably two-headed, right?"
He grinned at the thief's stunned expression.
"It's Opon's own. You've been serving a god and you didn't even know it. How's your luck been lately?"
He laughed again. Crocus stopped at a gate.
"This is the place, then?"
Fingers asked, glancing at the estate rising behind the compound wall.
"Well, there's a powerful mage living in there, ain't there? Well..."
He released the thief's arm.
"You should be safe enough inside. Good luck, boy. And I mean that. But listen..."
Fingers' eyes hardened.
"If your luck goes sour, you dump that coin, you hear?"
Confusion flickered across Crocus's face.
"Thank you, sir." "Ah, pleasure,"
Fingers said, as he placed his hands in his pockets again.
"Get a move on, then."
The adjunct broke away, taking a cut across her right shoulder blade as she did so. She ran, blood spraying with the effort, and the man did not pursue.
What a fool she had been, thinking that the coin-bearer wasn't protected. But who was that man? Never before had she faced such a swordsman, and the most appalling thing was that he had fought without the aid of sorcery. For once, her Ototeral blade and her skill had not been enough.
She staggered, half-blind down the street, then wheeled round a corner. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a flash of movement. The adjunct threw her back to a wall and raised her sword again. A large woman stood before her, regarding her quizzically.
"Looks to me," she drawled, "like you're already done."
"Leave me be," Lorne gasped.
"Can't do it," Mies said.
"We've been on you since Circlebreaker picked you up at the gate. The eel says you've got some things to pay for a lady. And we're here to collect."
As soon as the woman said that, the adjunct sensed another presence, immediately on her left. She cried out as she tried to spin into a defensive crouch, and in the cry was an overwhelming sense of frustration and despair.
"What a waste," she cursed.
"No, not like this!"
Even as that thought thundered through her head, both women attacked. She parried the blade coming at her from the left, but could only watch in horror as the woman who'd spoken revealed two blades, both driving for her chest. The adjunct screamed in rage as the weapons punched into her. Her sword clanged and bounded as it struck the cobbles. Hands groping, Lorne slid down the wall.
"Who?"
she managed, a blind need behind the word.
"Who?"
One of the women bent low over her.
"What's that?"
Anguish filled Lorne's face, the corners of her mouth drooping as her eyes closed.
"Who?"
she asked again.
"Who is this eel?" "Let's go, Mies,"
the woman said, ignoring the body at her feet. Parron found her sprawled on the grimy cobbles of an alley mouth. Something had drawn him to her unerringly, a final closing of the mysterious link between them. The sword was beside her, the grip slick with blood, its edges gouged and nicked. The captain crouched beside her.
"You made it a hard fight," he whispered, "for what that is worth."
He watched her eyes flicker open. She stared up at him as recognition arrived.
"Captain Ganoes."
"Adjunct?"
"They have killed me."
"Who?" She managed a stained smile.
"I don't know. Two women. Look like thieves. Thugs. Do you see the irony, Ganoes Parron?"
Thin-lipped, he nodded.
"No glorious end for the adjunct. If you'd come a few minutes sooner."
The captain said nothing. He watched the life leave Lorne, feeling nothing.
"Ill luck knowing me, adjunct. I'm sorry for that."
Then he collected the Ototeral sword and slipped it into his scabbard. Above him, two voices spoke in unison.
"You gave him our sword!"
He straightened to find himself facing a pond.
"The rope took it from me, to be more precise."
The twins could not conceal their fear. They looked upon Parron with something akin to pleading.
"Cotillion spared you," the sister said. "The hounds spared you. Why?"
Parron shrugged. "Do you blame the knife or the hand wielding it?"
"Shadow Throne never plays fair,"
the brother whined, hugging himself. "You and Cotillion both used mortals," the captain said, baring his teeth, "and paid for it. What do you want from me? Sympathy? Help?"
"That Ototeral blade,"
the sister said,
"will not be used to do your dirty work,"
Parron finished. "You'd best flee, O'Pon. I imagine even now Cotillion has given Shadowthrone the sword chance, and the two are putting their heads together to plan how best to use it." The twin jesters flinched. Parron laid a hand over the sword's sticky grip.
"Now, else I return Cotillion's favor."
The gods vanished. The captain drew a deep breath. He turned once again to Lorne. Her armor removed, she proved light in his arms. The air roared around Anamanda Rake as he plummeted, but he made no other sound, his warren drawn in tight around him. Below, now sweeping lazy circles over Darujistan, was the Dun Dragon, Rake's equal in size, with the power to match. But it was a fool, hunting for him in the streets below. Rake carefully spread his wings, angling toward the Galain Lord. His hind limbs reached down, talons spreading. He drew in the air around him, preparing for a burst of power. He was Kurald Galain, Tista Andi, and darkness was his home. The Galain Lord was immediately beneath him now, growing larger with incredible speed. Rake opened his mouth, head snapping back as he bit into a wall of air. This sound brought the Dun Dragon's gaze upward, but it was already too late. Chapter 24. I am the house imprisoning in my birth demonic hearts. So locked in each chamber, some trembling in raged antiquity. And these roots of stone spread the deepest cracks in parched ground, holding forever the dream of fruit. Ah, pilgrims, come to my door and starve. Azarth, Book 2, Chapter 3. Edaphon, birth date, unknown. The compound beyond the gate was empty. Crocus ran across it, wondering if he was too late. He bounded up the steps and reached for the door latch. A burst of energy flung him backward. Dazed, the thief found himself sitting on the paving stones before the steps, his flesh tingling. At the door, a deep crimson glow slowly faded. A ward. "Hood," he hissed, climbing to his feet. He had run into barriers like these before, in the higher estates. There was no way to get through them. Cursing again, Crocus whirled and raced to the gate. He emerged onto the street and looked around, seeing no one. If those crimson guards still protected him, they weren't showing themselves. There was a slight chance that the garden entrance to Baruch's estate was unguarded by magic. A very slight chance. He ran down the street and turned into the first alley to his right. There'd be a wall to scale, but he did not consider that much of an obstacle. He came to the alley's end and skidded to a halt on the street beyond. The wall was high, he saw. He'd need a running start. Crocus trotted across the street, trying to catch his breath. What was the point of all this? Couldn't Baruch take care of himself, after all? Wasn't he a high mage? And hadn't even Fingers commented on the alchemist's sorcerous defenses? He hesitated, scowling at the wall opposite him. At that moment, a piercing, earth-shaking scream was loosed directly above the street. Crocus threw himself against the wall behind him as an enormous shape descended into the gaslight. Filling the street, it struck the ground less than 20 yards to the thief's left. He was thrown from his feet by the impact. Stones shattered. He ducked beneath the hail of bricks and cobbles, then, as the scattering of rubble diminished, he jumped to his feet. A dragon, its wings tattered and streaked with blood, slowly regained its feet in the street, wagging its massive, wedge-shaped head from side to side. Along its brown flanks, scales had been torn away, revealing deep puncture wounds. Its neck and shoulders glistened with blood. Crocus saw that the wall beyond it, Baruch's, had been obliterated, opening the garden to his view. Snapped tree trunks rose amid steaming earth. A raised patio marked the approach of the estate's back entrance. Two toppled statues lay in pieces before the doors. The dragon looked stunned. Crocus tensed. Now was the time to move. Almost disbelieving his own temerity, the thief darted into the street behind the creature, hoping to reach the cover of the garden. His gaze remained on the dragon as he ran, his thoughts on the coin of luck in his pocket. Then, before his eyes, the creature's shape changed, drawing into itself in a shimmering haze. Crocus slowed, then stopped, unable to pull away his attention. His heart hammered against his ribs, as if seeking escape. Each drawn breath was a painful gasp. His luck, he told himself in terror, had just ended. The shimmering faded, and a giant, man-shaped apparition now stood on the street, cloaked and cowled. Crocus tried to will himself to move, but his body refused to obey. He stared, eyes widening, as the demon turned to him. It snarled and removed an enormous axe from its belt. Hefting the weapon, it spoke in a deep, soft voice.
"What reason to continue this?"
it asked reasonably.
"The Empress permits your escape, Lord. Once again, she grants you mercy. Accept it and leave."
"Good idea," the thief whispered. Then he frowned, for the demon's attention, he now saw, was directed past him. A man spoke behind him.
"We run no further, Ghislain."
A hand fell on the thief's shoulder, breaking the spell of immobility. Crocus ducked and spun to one side, then looked up into shifting indigo eyes set in a black, narrow face.
"Flee, mortal,"
the silver-haired man said, drawing a two-handed sword from the scabbard slung between his shoulder blades. The black weapon seemed almost invisible, as if it swallowed all light that found it.
"You are at the fate," Crocus blurted.
The man's eyes flickered, as if seeing him for the first time.
"Coin-bearer," he said with a wry smile. "Fear not. Brood has convinced me to spare you, at least for the moment. Begone, child."
His gaze returned to the Ghislain lord.
"This will be a close thing."
"I know that weapon,"
the demon snarled.
"Dragnipurik. And I smell the reek of Tiamma in you, Lord. There is more of her in you than Tista Andii blood."
Crocus backed against what remained of Baruch's wall. The Ghislain Lord grinned, revealing long, curved canines.
"The Empress would reward your services, Lord. You've only to say yes, and this battle can be avoided."
Anamanda Rake stepped forward.
"Attend, Ghislain."
With a roar, the demon attacked, axe whistling through the air and streaming blue flames. Rake whirled his sword in a circle, catching the axe and adding to its momentum. As the double blade swept past, the Tista Andii stepped in close, sword drawn back, pommel against his left hip. In a blur of motion, he extended the blade. The demon ducked, and releasing one hand from the axe haft, reached for Rake's throat. The Tista Andii twisted his right shoulder and caught the blow. Thrown backward, Rake landed heavily on the cobbles. The demon pounced, flaming weapon above its head. Rake regained his feet in time to catch the axe with his sword. The clash of weapons sent a jolt through the air and ground. The demon's axe flared bright white, cascading light like liquid. Rake's sword was swallowed in darkness, devouring the lashing waves of light that struck it. The flagstones beneath Crocus's feet tilted sickeningly, as if the stones themselves had turned to soft clay. Overhead, the stars swam wildly. Gripped by nausea, Crocus fell to his knees. Rake began to launch attacks, savage swings of his black weapon. At first, the demon held its ground, delivering fierce ripostes, then staggered back a step, then another. Relentless, Rake pressed his attack.
"To the mother's regret," he grated between blows, "was light granted birth. To her dismay, she saw too late. It's corruption. Ghislain, you are the unintended victim to punishment long overdue."
The demon reeled beneath the blows, desperately parrying every attack, no longer counterattacking. The light bleeding from the axe flickered, dimmed, flared fitfully as darkness closed in around the blade. Shrieking, the demon launched itself at Rake. As it descended over the Tista Andii, Crocus saw a streak of black burst from the demon's back, slicing through the cloak. The axe flew from the creature's hands, its fire dying as it clattered on the ground. Squealing in horror, the demon clawed at the sword, impaling it. Black smoke spread in swift tendrils from the weapon, engulfing the demon. The smoke twisted, became chains, drawing taut. The Galane screamed in earnest. Rake regained his feet and pushed the sword through the demon's chest until the hilt jammed against bone. The demon sank to its knees, its black eyes locking with Rake's own. The swimming stars settled. The flagstones beneath the thief became solid once again, though warped and twisted. Crocus swallowed bile, his eyes fixed on the demon. It seemed to collapse in on itself, the chains of black smoke ever tightening, pulling the creature into the sword. It toppled backward, and Rake drove the weapon's point into the cobbled street, pinning the demon. Then the Tista Andi leaned heavily on the hilt, and Crocus now noticed the blood-soaked cloth surrounding Rake's shoulder, where the demon's hand had struck. Wearily, the Tista Andi swung his gaze to the thief.
"Move quickly," he rasped. "The alchemist is in danger. I cannot protect him now. Hurry, coin-bearer!"
Crocus whirled and ran. The death of Travail, third in the Cabal, still echoed in their thoughts. The witch Derudan had inscribed an ash circle on the floor in the center of the chamber. With Baruch's help, she placed the two plush chairs within it, and now sat, smoking steadily, her dark eyes following the alchemist as he paced. Baruch found himself reluctant to enter the protective circle. While they would be safe there, surrounded by high tennis sorcery, they would not be able to counterattack should Vorkan arrive. More, some things could penetrate the defenses of magic. Ototaril, that strange rust-like ore from the Tano Hills of Seven Cities, immediately came to mind. It was unlikely that Vorkan would possess such material, given that she was a high mage, yet still Baruch felt reluctant to place himself in a position where he could not use his warren against the assassin.
"Those of the Cabal," Derudan said slowly, "who are now dead, yes? Stubborn, convinced of their own invincibility. No doubt they paced restless steps, awaiting the assassin's imminent arrival."
Baruch paused to reply, but was interrupted by a loud, inhuman scream from outside. This was followed immediately by a concussion that rattled the walls. The alchemist made a move toward the door.
"Wait!" Derudan called from the circle. "Appease not this curiosity, Baruch, for Vorkan will surely take advantage, yes?"
"A ward was shattered," Baruch said. "My defenses are breached."
"More the reason for caution," Derudan admonished. "Friend, I plead with you, join me here."
"Very well," Baruch sighed, moving toward her. A gust of air brushed the left side of his face.
Derudan cried out a warning even as the alchemist turned. Vorkan, her gloved hands glowing red, surged toward Baruch. He raised his arms, knowing full well that he would be too late. At that moment, however, another figure appeared, emerging from darkness to intercept the master assassin with a flurry of blows. Vorkan reeled back, then lashed out with a hand, catching her attacker a glancing blow. An agonized shriek ran through the chamber. Baruch stared, only now realizing that his protector was a Tista Andi woman. He stepped aside lightly as she flew past him to strike the floor, then the wall, where she lay unmoving. The alchemist pulled his gaze back to Vorkan, seeing that one of her hands no longer glowed. He gestured, and virulent sorcery erupted from his arm, arcing yellow lightning. Vorkan hissed a counterspell, and the lightning was swallowed by a red haze before her that dimmed quickly, then disappeared. She advanced. Vaguely, Baruch heard the witch Derudan shouting at him. Yet it was the mistress of the assassin's death-filled eyes that held him. The ease with which she dispelled his power made it clear that she was his master in sorcery. All he could do now, he understood with clarity, was await his death. But Baruch heard a grunt behind him. Then Vorkan gasped. The hilt of a dagger protruded from the assassin's chest. Frowning, she reached for it, then pulled it out and tossed it aside.
Oh?
The alchemist heard the Tista and E woman gasp from the floor behind him.
All I can do. My apologies, Lord.
Derudan appeared behind Vorkan. As she raised her hands and began an incantation, Vorkan whirled and something sped from her hand. The witch grunted, then crumpled. Anguish flooded Baruch. With a wordless roar, he launched himself at Vorkan. She laughed and ducked to one side, throwing out her glowing hand. The alchemist twisted, off balance, narrowly avoiding the killing touch, then staggered past. He heard her laughter again as she moved in behind him. A dozen feet in front of Baruch was the door. The alchemist's eyes widened to find it open. A youth crouched there, holding blockish objects in each hand. Expecting at any moment to feel Vorkan's touch, Baruch threw himself forward. He saw the boy straighten at the same time and thrust forward first his right arm, then his left. As the alchemist fell toward the door, two bricks flew over him. He heard them strike the woman behind him, one making a crunching sound, the other crackling. A flash of red accompanied the crackle. As he struck the floor, the breath was hammered from Baruch's lungs. Agonized seconds passed as he struggled to draw air into his tortured chest. He rolled onto his back. Vorkan, he saw, lay motionless almost against his feet. The boy's face came into view, streaked with sweat, brow furrowed with concern.
"Alchemist Baruch?"
he asked. The man nodded. The boy sighed, then grinned.
"You're alive! Good! Ralik sent me to warn you."
Baruch sat up.
"The witch," he said hoarsely. He pointed. "Tend to her, please."
He felt his strength returning as he watched the boy crouch beside Derudan.
"She's breathing," Crocus announced. "There's some kind of knife in her. Looks like it's covered in sap."
He reached down to touch it.
"No!"
Baruch shouted. Crocus jumped back in alarm.
"Poison," the alchemist said, climbing to his feet. "Help me to her, quickly."
A moment later, he knelt beside Derudan. A quick glance at the sap-like substance coating the blade confirmed his suspicion.
"White parrot," he said.
"That's a spider, isn't it?"
Baruch laid a hand on Derudan.
"Your knowledge surprises me, boy," he said. "Fortunately, she's in the home of the man who possesses its antidote."
He muttered something, and a vial appeared in his hand.
"Ralik said there was no antidote to white parrot."
"It's not something I'm likely to announce."
Baruch unstoppered the vial and poured the contents down the witch's throat, triggering a coughing fit. As Derudan's breathing became even, Baruch leaned back and eyed Crocus.
"You seem well acquainted with Ralik. What's your name?"
"Crocus. Mamet was my uncle, sir. I saw him die."
Derudan's eyelids flickered, then opened. She smiled lazily.
"What I see pleases me," she said weakly. "Yes?"
Baruch returned the smile.
"Yes, my friend. But I make no claim for defeating Vorkan. That falls to Crocus, nephew of Mamet."
Derudan's gaze swung to the youth.
"Ah, the one I came near to treading on earlier this evening."
The amusement left her expression.
"I am sorry for Mamet, child."
"So am I," he replied.
Baruch rose and turned. He hissed a vehement curse. Vorkan's body was gone.
"She's fled."
He hurried over to the Tista Andi woman. He bent down and examined her. She was dead.
"I will soon know your name," he whispered.
and I will remember it.
I have to go, Crocus announced.
Baruch wondered at the sudden panic in the boy's face.
I mean, Crocus continued, if everything's over here, that is.
I believe it is, the alchemist answered. I thank you, Crocus, for your skill at throwing bricks.
The boy went to the door. He paused, then tossed a coin into the air. He caught it and grinned tightly.
Just lucky, I suppose.
Then he was gone. Captain Parron crouched beside Cole's bed.
Still asleep, he said, rising and facing Whiskey Jack. Go ahead.
Kalam and the two saboteurs had arrived minutes earlier. So far, the sergeant mused, no losses. Though the captain's armor had taken a beating, and the look in his face when he'd entered the room with Lorne's body in his arms warned Whiskey Jack away from probing Parron's state of mind too deeply. The adjunct's body now occupied a second bed, motionless and pale, a strange, ironic smile curving her bloodless lips. The sergeant studied everyone in the small room, the faces he knew so well all watching him, waiting. His gaze held on Sorry, or Absalar, as she now called herself. Whatever Mallet had done to her, she was a changed woman from the one he had known. Less, and somehow more as well. Even Mallet was unsure of what he had done. Certain memories, skills had been freed, and with them a brutal knowledge. The pain was there in the woman's eyes, a pain layered in years of horror. Yet it seemed that she had it under control, that she had found a way, a strength, to live with what she had been. Her only words upon meeting him had been,
I wish to return home, Sergeant.
He had no objection, though he wondered how she planned to cross two continents and the ocean between them. Whiskey Jack reached for the wrapped forearm bones laying on the table.
Yes, sir, he said, in answer to Parron's command.
The hot, sweaty air in the room thickened with tension. Whiskey Jack hesitated. There'd been a battle in Darujistan's streets, and Quick Ben had confirmed the Galen Lord's death. In fact, the Black Wizard seemed still in shock. The sergeant sighed under his breath and massaged his newly healed leg, then drove the forearm's blade into the tabletop. Contact was immediate. High Fist Dujek's gravelly voice filled the room.
About time, Whiskey Jack. Don't bother telling me about the Galen Lord. Tayshren's in a coma or something. Everyone in headquarters heard his scream. So Anamanda Rake took out the beast. What else?
Whiskey Jack glanced at Parron, who nodded deferentially.
Adjunct Lorne's gambit failed, the sergeant said. She's dead. We have her body with us. The intersections remain mined. We're not detonating them, High Fist, since they're likely to open the gas caverns beneath the city and turn us all into ash. So.
He took a deep breath, feeling a twinge from his leg. Mallet had done what he could, and that had been a lot, but some damage remained, and it made him feel fragile.
So, he repeated softly, we're pulling out, High Fist.
Dujek was silent. Then he grunted.
Problems, Whiskey Jack. One, we're about to lose Pale. As I suspected, Caladan Brood left the Crimson Guard to handle things up north and marched down here with his Tista Andi. He's also got Rivi with him and Jorix Bargast, who's just finished chewing up Gold Maranth. Two, it gets worse.
The High Fist swallowed audibly.
Seven Cities is maybe a week away from open rebellion. The Empress knows it. Some claw from Janabaris arrived half an hour ago looking for Tayshren. My people got to him first. Whiskey Jack, he was carrying a handwritten message from the Empress to Tayshren. I've just been outlawed by the Empire. It's official, and Tayshren was to have effected my arrest and execution. We're on our own, friend.
The room was silent. Whiskey Jack closed his eyes briefly.
Understood, High Fist. So, when do you march?
Seems the Black Maranth are with us, don't ask why. Anyway, I have a parley at dawn tomorrow with Caladan Brood and Kalor. That will decide matters, I suspect. Either he lets us walk, or he kills us taking Pale. Everything's riding on what he knows about the Panion Seer.
Whiskey Jack said,
We're rendezvousing with some Black Maranth in a couple of days, Ifist. Makes me wonder how much they'd guessed when that arrangement was made. Anyway, they'll take us to you, wherever you are.
No, Dujek replied. We may be under siege here. The Black will drop you off on the Catlin Plain. Their orders are clear on this, but you're welcome to try overruling them.
The sergeant grimaced. Not likely.
Catlin Plain it is. Just means it'll take us longer to get to you, sir.
The glow surrounding the burns flickered briefly, and they heard an echoing thump. Fiddler chuckled. Dujek had just pounded a fist on the table at his end of the conversation. Whiskey Jack shot the saboteur a ferocious look.
Captain Perrin!
Dujek bellowed.
Here, Ifist,
Perrin replied, stepping forward.
What I'm about to say is to Whiskey Jack, but I want you to hear it, Captain.
I'm listening.
Sergeant, if you want to be in my army, you'd better get used to the new order. First, I'm placing the bridge burners under Captain Perrin's command. Second, you're not a sergeant anymore, Whiskey Jack. You're my second in command, and that means responsibilities. I don't want you anywhere near Pale, and you know I'm right, damn it. Captain Perrin?
Yes?
Whiskey Jack's squad has earned the right to walk. Understood? If any of them elect to rejoin the bridge burners, fine. But I don't want any recriminations if they decide otherwise. I trust that's clear.
Yes, Ifist.
And with Whiskey Jack between commissions,
Dujek continued inexorably,
he's just coming along for the ride. If you follow me, Captain.
Perrin grinned. I do.
Now, the Black Maranth will know the story by the time they pick you up, so go with them.
Yes, Ifist.
Dujek growled.
Questions, Whiskey Jack?
No,
the grizzled veteran answered glumly.
All right. Hopefully we'll talk later.
The bones glow died. Captain Perrin rounded on the soldiers. He studied each face.
They were to have been my command. I could not have done better anywhere, he thought.
Very well, he said gruffly. Who is ready to be outlawed and counted among Dujek's rebels?
Trotz was the first to rise, his teeth bared. He was followed by Quickben, Hedge, and Mallet. There was a shocked silence, then Kalam nodded at Fiddler and cleared his throat.
We're with you, only we're not going with you. Me and Fiddler, that is.
Can you explain that?
Perrin asked quietly.
Absalar spoke up, surprising everyone. They'll find that hard to do, Captain. And I admit, I'm not sure what they're up to, but they're coming with me. Back to the Empire. Home.
With an uneasy shrug, Fiddler rose and faced Whiskey Jack.
We feel we owe it to her, sir, he said.
He looked to the captain.
And we're settled on it, sir. But we're coming back, if we can.
Bemused, Whiskey Jack pushed himself painfully to his feet. As he turned to face Perrin, he froze. Behind the captain, Cole sat upright on the bed. Whiskey Jack said, gesturing. Tension burgeoned in the room once again as everyone swung to Cole. Perrin stepped forward in genuine relief.
Carl, I'm...
He stopped abruptly, then said tonelessly,
You've been awake for some time, I see.
Carl's eyes flicked to the bones stuck in the tabletop, then returned to Perrin.
Heard it all, he said. So tell me, Perrin, do you soldiers need any help getting out of Dirujistan?
Ralik stood in the darkness beneath the trees at the edge of the glade. It seemed that his magic deadening powers had proved insufficient after all. He had been driven from his seat by what had felt like a giant hand, a god's hand, sure and powerful and unyielding. He had watched in astonishment as a maze of roots clambered swiftly across the clearing, headed toward the terrace. He had heard a shriek, then the roots returned, wrapped around a man-shaped apparition, which the roots pulled unceremoniously into the earth. Ralik had been filled suddenly with near euphoria. He knew with unaccountable certainty that what grew here was right and just. It was new, young. Even now, as he continued watching it, he saw trembles of shaping ripple beneath its angular geometric surfaces. What had been no more than a tree stump less than an hour ago was now a house. A massive door lay half buried in shadows beneath an arching branch. Vines barred shuttered windows. A balcony hung above and to the left of the door, festooned with leaves and creepers. It led into a kind of tower, turreted above the second story and shingled to a gnarled peak. Another tower marked the house's front right flank. This one stockier and windowless, its roof flat with jagged merlons lining the edge. He suspected that this roof was a platform, with access through a trapdoor of some kind. The glade around the structure had changed too, becoming mounded here and there, as if the house's yard was a burial ground. Young, scraggly trees ringed each oblong mound, each growing as if an invisible wind twisted them away from the humped, grassy earth. The roots had dragged the apparition into one such mound. It felt right and just. These two words echoed in the assassin's head, with an appeal that wrapped calm around his heart. He almost imagined he felt an affinity with this child house, as if it knew of him and accepted him. He knew the house to be empty, another sourceless certainty. Ralik continued watching as the lines of the house grew firm, sharply defined. A musty smell pervaded the area, as of freshly turned earth. The assassin felt at peace. A moment later he heard thrashing behind him, and whirled to see Vorkan stagger through the undergrowth. Her face was covered in blood from a gash to her brow, and she nearly collapsed into Ralik's arms.
"Sister Andy," she gasped. "After me. Hunting. They seek to avenge a murder."
Ralik looked past her, and his eyes, long accustomed to the surrounding darkness, detected silent movement among the trees, closing in. He hesitated, gripping the now unconscious woman in his arms. Then he bent down, threw Vorkan over one shoulder, turned, and ran toward the house. He knew that the door would open for him, and it did. Beyond was a dark antechamber, and an archway leading into a hallway running from side to side. A gust of warm, sweet air flowed over Ralik, and he entered without pause. Korlat, blood kin to Serat, slowed as she approached the strange house. The door had closed behind their quarry. She came to the edge of the clearing, then squatted on her haunches. Her fellow hunters gathered slowly around her. Horolt hissed angrily, then said,
"Have you summoned our lord, Korlat?"
The woman shook her head.
"I know of such creations from old," she said. "The dead house of Malar City, the Yordhan house of seven cities, Asarth Adi Ayaman, pillars of innocence. This door will not open to us."
"Yet it opened to them," Horolt said.
"There is precedence. The Azath choose their own. It was so with the dead house. Two men were chosen, one who would be emperor, the other who would accompany him, Kelenved and Dancer." "I sense its power,"
Orphantal whispered.
"Our lord could destroy it now, while it's still young."
"Yes," agreed Korlat, "he could."
She was silent a moment, then she rose.
"I am bloodkin to the fallen," she said.
"You are bloodkin," the others intoned.
"The quest for vengeance is ended,"
Korlat said, the lines around her almond-shaped eyes tightening.
"Our lord will not be summoned. Leave him to his recovery. The Asarth will not be touched, for it is new. A child."
Her eyes, soft brown, slowly regarded those of her companions.
The Queen of Darkness spoke thus of light when it was first born. It is new, and what is new is innocent, and what is innocent is precious. Observe this child of wonder, and know respect.
Orphantal scowled.
Thus did light survive, and so was darkness destroyed, the purity vanquished. And now you would have us flawed, as our queen was flawed. Light became corrupted, and destroyed our world, Korlat. Or have you forgotten?
Korlat's smile was a sad one.
Cherish such flaws, dear brother, for our queen's was hope. And so is mine. Now we must leave.
Cropper's expression was benign as he watched Crocus approached, clearly exhausted by this night of endless running. He nudged Murillo and fluttered his fingers in the young thief's direction.
The lad returns with undue haste, yet I fear such sad tidings as Cropper must bring.
He's had a rough night all around, Murillo commented.
He leaned against the gate's support wall outside the Simtal estate. The streets remained empty, the citizens shocked numb with the night's horrors. Cropper gestured at Moonspawn, now a league to the west, well beyond the city's walls.
A remarkable contraption, that. However, Cropper is pleased that it has chosen to depart. Imagine, even the stars blotted out, leaving naught but dread in this world.
I need a drink, Murillo muttered.
Excellent idea, Cropper said. Shall we await the lad, however?
The wait was not long. Crocus recognized them and slowed his frantic run.
Hapsel has been kidnapped by the Empire, he shouted. I need help.
He wobbled to a halt before Murillo.
And Ralik's still in the garden.
Tut, tut, Cropper said. Easy, lad. Apsalar's location is known to Cropper. As for Ralik, well...
He faced the street and waved his arms expansively.
Breathe the night air, Crocus. A new year has begun. Come, let us walk, the three of us, masters of Darujistan.
He linked arms with his comrades and pulled them forward. Murillo sighed.
Ralik's missing, he explained. There's some kind of extraordinary house in Cole's garden now.
Ah, so much unveiled in that single statement.
Cropper leaned against Crocus.
While no doubt the lad's secret, overriding concern at the moment, regards the fate of a fair young maiden, whose life was saved at the last moment by a noble son named Gorlas, of all things. Saved, Cropper says, from a ton of masonry shrugged off a wall. 'Twas heroic indeed. The last near swooned with satisfaction.
What are you talking about?
Crocus demanded.
Who was saved?
Murillo snorted.
I think, dear Cropper, master of Darujistan, you've got the wrong fair maiden in mind.
She's not fair, anyway,
Crocus asserted. Cropper's chest swelled slightly.
You need but ask the gods, lad, and they'll tell that life isn't fair. Now, are you interested in how Lady Simtal's estate has just this night become Cole's estate? Or is your mind so thoroughly enamored of this new love of yours that even the fates of your dearest friends, Cropper included, yield such lack of interest?
Crocus bridled.
Of course I'm interested.
Then the story begins, as always, with Cropper.
Murillo groaned.
Thus spake the eel.
Epilogue. I have seen a rumour born swathed in snug mystery, left lying under the sun in the hills of the Gadrobi, where the sheep have scattered on wolf-laden winds, and the shepherds have fled a whispering of sands. and it blinked in the glare, a heart hardened into stone, while the shadow of the gates of nowhere crept across the drifting dust of home. I have seen this rumor born, 100,000 hunters of the heart, in a city bathed in blue light. Rumor Born, Chapter 1, Verses 1 through 4. Fisher, birthdate unknown. The sun lit the morning mists into a shield of white over the lake. Down on the beach, a fisher boat rocked in the freshening waves. Unmoored, it was moments before pulling free of the pebbles. Mallet helped Whiskey Jack to a dome of rock above the beach, where they sat. The healer's gaze hesitated on the figure of Quick Ben, standing with shoulders hunched and staring across the lake. He followed the wizard's gaze. Moonspawn hung low on the horizon, a gold cast to its ravage bustled. Mallet grunted.
It's heading south. I wonder what that means.
Whiskey Jack squinted against the glare. He began to massage his temples.
More headaches?
Mallet asked. Not so bad lately, the grizzled man said.
It's the leg that worries me,
the healer muttered.
I need to work on it some more, and you need to stay off it a while.
Whiskey Jack grinned. As soon as there's time, he said. Mallet sighed.
We'll work on it then.
From the forested slope behind them, Hedge called,
They're coming in!
The healer helped Whiskey Jack stand.
God knows,
he whispered.
It could have been a lot worse, right, Sergeant?
Whiskey Jack glared across the lake.
Three lost ain't that bad, considering.
A pained expression crossed Mallet's face. He said nothing.
Let's move, Whiskey Jack growled. Captain Parron hates tardiness, and maybe the Maranth have good news. Be a change, wouldn't it?
From the beach, Quick Ben watched Mallet supporting his sergeant up the slope. Was it time, he wondered. To stay alive in this business, no one could afford to let up. The best plans work inside other plans, and when it's right to faint, faint big. Keeping the other hand hidden is the hard part. The wizard felt a stab of regret.
No, it wasn't time.
Give the old man a chance to rest. He forced himself into motion. He wouldn't let himself look back. Never a good idea. The scheme was hatched.
Whiskey Jack's going to howl when he hears this one, he whispered to himself.
Captain Parron listened to the others on the beach below, but made no move to join them. Not yet. His brush with Ascendance seemed to have left him with a new sensitivity. Or perhaps it was the Ototaral sword scabbarded at his side. But he could sense her, now, already in her adolescence, plump as he knew she'd be, smiling with her heavy-lidded eyes deceptively sleepy as she studied the morning sky.
I will come to you, he promised her.
When this Panion Seer and his cursed holy war is crushed,
I will come to you then, Tattersail.
I know.
He stiffened. That voice in his head had not been his own.
Or had it?
He waited. Waited for more.
Tattersail?
Only silence answered him. Ah, my imagination. Nothing more. To think you would call up enough of your old life to find the feelings you once held for me. Find them and feel them once again. I am a fool. He rose from his crouch at Lorne's graveside, a mound of rocks, and brushed twigs and orange pine needles from his clothing. Look at me now, agent for the adjunct once, now a soldier, finally a soldier. Smiling, he made his way down to his squad. Then I shall await the coming of a soldier. Parron stopped in his tracks, then smiling, continued on.
Now that, he whispered, was not my imagination.
The tradecraft hugged the southern shore, making for Davran and the river mouth. Kalam leaned on the gunwale, his gaze sweeping the north horizon's ragged, snow-capped mountains. Near him stood another passenger, hardly memorable and disinclined to talk. The only voices reaching the assassin came from Absalar and Crocus. They sounded excited, each revolving around the other in a subtle dance that was yet to find its accompanying words. A slow half-smile quirked Kalani.